if you like betting on golf. But everyone that you back misses the cut. Get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the golf betting system. The golf betting system is the golf betting system podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Golf Betting System podcast 196, featuring the Waste Management Phoenix Open on the PGA Tour and the Ras Al Khaimah Classic on the DP World Tour. Paul Williams and Barry O'Hanrahan join me, Steve Bamford, to discuss this week's golf betting action. Good morning, gents.
Morning, guys.
Morning, guys.
Please subscribe to this podcast as you drive the popularity of the show. This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. Please be gamble aware. You can visit begambleaware.org for more info and, of course, please bet responsibly. Visit our world-famous golf betting system website with our in-depth betting previews. They went out yesterday on Twitter. They're available, of course, at Golf Betting System. Tournament strokes gained analysis, masses of tournament form statistics and our predictor models. All of these features with this podcast are available completely free of charge with no paywall. Right, Barry is at A Good Talk Golf on Twitter. Paul is at Golf Betting. I am at Bamford Golf. You can join our Golf Betting System Facebook group. The link is available in the description box. Plus, look out for the Steve Bamford Golf YouTube channel where I present the Golf Betting Show every week. Please subscribe and like the shows. I'll be recording that show after we finished recording this pod. Now, you guys as listeners power this podcast. I say the same thing every week, but it's true. So we need your five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. As ever, for those of you who leave a review, I will read them out at the start of a future show. Now, we have a very short, sweet one here, guys. It's entitled Good Stuff. It's five stars, of course. It's from Brent076 in the United States of America. Here we go. Are you ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
We are, and I quote, an easy listen, very informative, actionable information. That's brilliant. Thank you, Brent. Very, very good. Five-star review from Brent076. So let me go through that again. Easy listen, very informative, actionable information. It's like being in a meeting again like 15 years ago, Paul, when we used to work.
Yeah.
It's like a telegram. I like it.
What kind of actionable information do you think he's talking about? Is it like looking at our tips and instantly crossing them off?
Avoidance, yeah.
it brings the field down slightly, doesn't it? No, I suspect there's a lot of data, isn't there? There's a lot of data in what we talk about. There's a lot of stats on the site, on the previews, and hopefully the full package does help many of you to narrow your fields down and pluck a few winners out. Certainly, I see a lot of people and a lot of people come back to us, don't they, with the winners that they've got and how they've managed to achieve them via the stats or via the stuff that we've talked about. It's great to see that. So if you can pluck a few winners out from the information we give you, then all well and good. Good luck to you.
Let's talk about last week's. We've got another packed show. Waste Management Phoenix Open, always one of the highlights, I think, of the PGA Tour. Yep. Let's start with Saudi. I just thought it was hilarious that Harold Varner III has now won two professional tournaments. One of them was in Australia, and one of them is now in Saudi Arabia. Because whenever he's carried my money on the PGA Tour, the old knees start knocking on a Sunday afternoon, and it starts spreading all over the place. But he actually showed some real heart, if you actually look at how he won that. I think he bogeyed 16, and then was it birdie 17, eagle 18? Is something crazy like that?
Did you see the putt on 18 to win it?
No, I didn't know.
Have a little search around Twitter. It was
it a long one?
About 120 feet, I think it was. It was from slightly off the green.
I get a little bit of hyperbole. I think they were shown 92 in the clips I saw. It was something else, Steve. Yeah, it was beautiful putting. Look, fair play to Harold. Winning is difficult no matter where it is. And maybe he just needs to do a slightly circuitous route to get his head in the right space to be able to win on the PGA Tour. And this is another building block. So
yeah, I agree.
Great for him. How can you not like him?
I've said for years, a lot of these guys, they win at different rates. I always bring up Jimmy Walker as the example. Went on forever, not winning. Jimmy can't win. He's got no ball, you know, hasn't got the bottle, hasn't got the mental fortitude. And then he won one, and all of a sudden he was winning at a very regular rate.
Mm.
So we might see that, could see that with Tom Hoge. If you look at Tom Hoge and his win, I know that lots of you were on last week, guys, in the listening, and the listeners. Tom Hoge, very popular. But you actually look at the way that guy has been playing over the last 3 months. His approach play and his around the green game is absolutely elite. So, you know, you have got players out there that are really raising their standards. I'm just trying to think. Russell Henley is, you know, he's been very, very strong recently. There's a lot of good players just under the surface that are bubbling up towards the top 50 in the world or breaking into the top 50. And we've said for a while, Rivana, now he's got all the attributes. I can remember him playing in the final group of the PGA Championship at Bethpage Black. I mean, to get into the final group of a major around Bethpage Black, you've got to be some kind of player.
Yeah.
So it's there. The raw materials are there. It's just, it's always between the ears, isn't it, with a lot of them.
Well, and, you know, you've got to get yourself in position. And, you know, when the door's ajar, it can either be taken or not. I mean, had he knocked that putt 10 feet past, and from the distance he was, it's not inconceivable. He knocks that 10 feet past, misses the return putt and loses. But instead, he jars it and wins the golf tournament. And, you know, in that one shot, that one putt, you've got an incredible swing from what could potentially happen to what actually did happen in the context of his career. So, you know, from our perspective, from any punter's perspective, you just got to keep putting your players in the position where they can potentially win, and you know, and take your chances on a Sunday and hope that overall the variance kind of evens itself out and you get some good Sundays to go alongside the bad Sundays, which inevitably happen.
I did a tweet last Thursday. It was my first ever poll on Twitter. Do Bryson and Phil join the Saudi Super Golf League? And we had four answers. Both do, neither do. Phil joins, Bryson doesn't. Bryson joins, Phil doesn't. Here are the results. 501 votes. Both, 27%. Neither, 35%. Phil joins, Bryson doesn't. I can see that, 32%. Bryson joins, Phil doesn't, 7%. What are your thoughts if I was to ask the question, gentlemen? To you two.
Barry, you first. I think the thing that's going to be a huge dictating factor in anybody taking those gigantic checks that are being spoken of is the blocker will be the majors stopping people. As soon as they join that league, that's it. You're out of the majors. You can't play. You can't play the Ryder Cup. You can't play President's Cup. And that's the blocker. And I guess we've been talking and messaging a bit offline about this as well. Thinking that right now it's looking like it's a league for the fading lights of golf, or let's say the previously bright stars in golf who probably aren't competitive in majors anymore, and this is their pension fund or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then what's the point? Because you don't get those big stars that they really want to have. So I don't know if it all just fizzles out. Or if it just eventually forces an actual world tour to come into existence. And we're seeing the seeds of that right now with the cross-recognition of tournaments, with the Scottish Open being recognised for the PGA Tour, and then there's a couple on the European Tour getting backwards recognition the other way. So I think they're the early stages of it, and they're just it'll maybe come in over the next few years. They're never going to jump that quickly, but that I think that's where we ultimately end up.
So interesting kind of analogy with players who are, I guess, the players who are at the back end of a career. Similar kind of thing, I guess, you get with professional football in terms of players going off to, you know, the likes of America or China at the back end of their career for a payday for a year or two. And, you know, is that or has that ever been seen as a threat to the Premier League football? No, of course not, because it's a different type of player, effectively, who's going to do it. The danger is, of course, that a player like Bryson does go. To answer your question, Steve, of the two, I could potentially see Phil going if either of them were to go, because yeah. I think he's the kind of person who will happily take the money. And, you know, Bryson has got a lot more of his, you know, immediate career in front of him, whereas Phil, well, ultimately, you know, he's still competitive, reasonably competitive at PGA Tour level, but, you know, the days and the number of days that he's got left at that level are dwindling. And, you know, does he go and play on the Champions Circuit or does he go and get a payday over in Saudi? It's, you know, it may come down to as simple as what the numbers look like.
I mean, it's normal business practice, but the players that they've contacted have all signed NDAs. I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? And it seems to me that, and this, I think, was the way that it was always going to go, they're using Phil as the conduit.
Yep.
They're using Phil and his management team to be the guys that are behind the scenes in the locker rooms and, you know, where players meet and talking about this. And Bryson's clearly gone to a level where he's gone to the point where, oh, well, make us an offer, and they have. So, I don't know. Going back to the poll, I could see neither. I could see there's talk of Phil getting some kind of share ownership or some kind of input into the Champions Tour on the PGA, because clearly, you know, he's winning lots in that already. And you've got players like Jim Furyk, Vijay Singh, so they've got some big names. Those names are only going to get bigger and brighter as time moves on. And as you said, Barry, it's this major situation, isn't it? You know, can Jay Monahan and Keith Pelly, to a lesser degree, get all of the four governing bodies of the majors to agree to the fact that if anyone plays this, none of those players can play in a major championship? Because that's what they'd need to do, isn't it? USGA with the US Open, PGA of America for the PGA Championship, Royal and Ancient for the Open, and clearly the Masters Organising Committee. Because that's the ultimate threat. I know that the DP World Tour are already saying, oh, you know, if one of our players goes, that it's endangering them being a captain of a future Ryder Cup team. All of these discussions and things are happening behind the scenes. So it'll be interesting. I did read that there's going to be a tournament over here in St Albans, isn't there, Paul, at the Centurion?
Yeah, apparently so.
In the summer, apparently.
Yeah.
I have no idea. At the moment, he's going to have Jazz General Watanand probably going to be the star of the tournament at this rate. But the money talks, doesn't it? And clearly, the PIF out in Saudi Arabia have got ridiculous amount of funds available, as we're going to see with Newcastle United over the next 5 to 10 years. So,
I just thought
it was interesting.
Evolving situation, isn't it?
Money cannot buy history, and golf has so much history, and majors are that like big thing in history that players chase. And not there's anybody who I can't. I mean, look, there are ridiculous sums of money there, but
thing is,
can they replace the opportunity, you know, to go have majors and have your career be built around chasing majors rather than just being I don't know, gun for hire.
I don't know if you noticed, but when you looked at the Asian Tour leaderboard this week and you went into the detail on the players, there was a points system on there. So they were, they were accumulating points for the fairways hit, the greens hit, and all this kind of stuff. So that must be a kind of precursor that they're putting in place, because there's going to be a team element to this Super League, isn't there? It's not just going to be sort of normal tournament golf. They're going to have teams, and it's all going to be a bit different, apparently. So, yeah, there were points being accrued. Yeah, it means nothing to me. At the end of the day, we try and pick the winner each week, but you I think what you said, Barry, is also very critical. If they're going to sign up, I don't know, I'm just trying to think of some name, a Kevin Na or, you know, a Lee Westwood or a Poulter and they get players of that ilk, is that really then going to be something that we're all going to be dying to tune into, to watch? And that's ultimately what we're talking about, isn't it? It needs to be a product that millions of people across the globe are willing to actually tune into watch, because otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, and it's got to be competitive in terms of, you know, you wanting to watch it versus a DP World Tour event or a PGA Tour event that may be happening at the same time or, you know, on the same days or you know, fully clashing potentially, depending on the time zones, with the events that are
on. That's the other thing. If you're watching this tour and it's like, oh, we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time at X, and none of those players are involved in any majors or, you know, in the whole world of golf as it works, you know, it just doesn't seem to make much sense to me. It's just like you said, it's like a pension scheme for players that are probably over the hill or are willing to take the cash rather than play majors and potentially not win them.
Cash is the real kind of talking point here for me, in that as golf fans, we just don't care week to week how much these guys are winning.
No.
You know, it's compared to other sports, yes, it seems like the top guys are quite significantly underpaid, but it doesn't matter to me emotionally when I'm watching a tournament how much these guys are playing for. What matters is the prestige of the tournament. So they can put any figure on any week in a golf league. It just doesn't matter. It's the entertainment and the prestige of the tournament that gets me amped up for it. And this is why the majors are such a big thing for us, because they've had so much history building up over time. Yeah. And they're the four key events. And then the players is somewhat shoehorned its way into being, you know, a huge thing, because it has a thing of being the strongest field in golf, and they've also felt like they've had to ramp up the money in that. So I think what the Players is now the most valuable tournament, but it doesn't matter to me. I don't care what the prize money for it is. Winning the Players is a big thing, and that's what matters to me as a fan when I'm watching. I know it's a big deal because it's the strongest field in golf. So that gives it its thing. But on a week-to-week basis, if they're saying, oh, the winning team this week gets like $85 million each, I mean, it just, the figures don't make any difference to me.
No.
So that's why it just seems to fall flat in its face.
Yeah,
for me.
It's also the familiarity. I mean, you're talking about the plays, talking about TPC Sawgrass. I really enjoy that, because you're going back to the same course that you've seen for a number of years. You know the intricacies of it as a viewer, as a punter, and you know, there's excitement there because you know what's coming up on various holes. Same with the Masters over here. Same with the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth. If you're going to random courses that you've never seen before with a lesser field or a lesser profile field, because they're kind of, I don't know, almost been brushed under the carpet, you know, due to their having gone and played part of this league, perhaps, I don't know, does it lose all of its gravitas? I don't know. We'll see how it all unfolds.
The Players' Championship prize fund is up to $20 million, and the winner's getting £3,600,000.
But that doesn't matter to us.
No.
I just don't care about it.
It's true. I suppose, it's the prize money, it's the Saudi situation. There's all of these discussions that Phil's bringing up about digital rights, about ownership the players should be getting, that the PGA Tour have got control of right now. It's a real political mess, isn't it? Anyway, I think we've spoken enough about that. Let's actually get on to some golf, shall we? There's a cracking tournament this week over in the United States on Super Bowl weekend, as ever. It's the Waste Management Phoenix Open, which is always one of my faves. I like the course. I was thinking about this morning, actually. It's one of those courses. I mean, we cover golf every week of the year up to the end of November, and a lot of courses I have to seriously refresh myself of the holes, but I can always remember the last four holes here.
Yeah,
15, par 5, onto the island, drivable par 5, but it's an island green. 16, of course, you have the stadium hole and all the shenanigans going on there. I reckon there could be over 600,000 spectators there this week over the 4 days. 17, which is an amazing hole, which is clearly where Koepka chipped in last year, that drivable par 4 with water all the way down the left. That's a cracking hole. You know, do you go with driver like Ricky did that year, and he blew it through the back?
Yeah, yeah. Into the water. You got water down the left and water over the back
and,
as well,
and the back, yeah, back of the green and all the way down the left. It's a cracking hole. And then, of course, you've got the closing 18th, with it, you know, it's downhill, down and left. Got some nasty kind of bunkers on the left side. You've got all the spectators on the hill on the right side of the green and the hole. So it's a really good closing stretch of golf, I always think. Always, always a close finish here as well. So you always get congested leaderboard. My advice would be always take some extra additional each way places here, because there's a lot of tyres, there's a lot of movement, late movement on the leaderboard as well. So actually, you know, from a trading perspective, if you've got the wherewithal to do that, there's definitely opportunities. Let's get into the detail of the course, the stadium course. They've played here for donkey's years. TPC Scottsdale in Scottsdale, Arizona, which, as we know, is a big centre for a lot of golfers live in Scottsdale. Great weather all year, excellent practice facilities and the like. It is a Tom Weisskopf and Jay Morrish 1995 original. There was a Weisskopf redesign in 2014, which made it slightly more difficult, I think. I categorise this as a desert golf course, of course, but also resort in terms of its scoring. Now, that does, though, sometimes change, and it might change this year, because there is wind in the forecast, likely, and also they have had, I know it sounds ridiculous because it's in the desert, but they have had very, very little rain in the build-up here. I mean, when I did my homework on this over the weekend, I think it was 2 millimetres of rain they've had in January, from 1st of January onwards, so this year.
Mm.
Now, clearly, they irrigation systems and whatever, but as you said, Barry, and it was noticeable last week at Pebble, by the close of that tournament, you know, you're looking at the divots, it was very dry, the soil at Pebble Beach, and the greens were releasing to a level on the closing Sunday. You know, you were shooting a 68 round Pebble, you were shooting a good score, and there was no wind around. So when you're seeing scoring of that level, that would suggest that the greens had release in them and there was a bit of a challenge to the course, which is what we like to see. I get a feeling this might be similar this week, you know. Might be similar this week.
There's a bit of pop in the ball and the ball bouncing. It made it interesting. There was a bit more to consider than just throwing darts.
Yeah.
Much more interesting to watch. And I backed Joel Damon last week. I don't think I mentioned him on the pod, but just took a flyer on him. And I was in a very excited mood when he got to 17 under, and then he hit that difficult stretch of holes that were, you know, a little bit of wind out there. The greens were a little bit of a challenge, tricky to put on, bit of bounce on the approach shots, and he just could not stop making bogeys. Now, he surged and finished strong to get a full place. So, you know, happy days on to next week. But it was, more of that, please. If you just a little bit of a challenge. It wasn't brutally tough, but interesting and engaging to watch.
I'm just looking at Windfinder, Scottsdale Airport. Dead, dead calm Thursday, Friday. It's going to be scoring heaven, 25 degrees, 23 degrees. Saturday's the day that's up for debate, and it keeps changing. It's been changing every time I look at it. They're saying at the moment gusts at lunchtime up to 20 miles an hour, and then it sort of disappears back more to 15 miles an hour gusts in the afternoon. That has been stronger than that, so we'll just keep an eye on that. That will dictate scoring the Saturday. Sunday looks calm again. But just with that forecast, and if there isn't much wind on the Saturday, I genuinely think, and they do it here, the organisers, they'll let this course dry out. So Saturday and Sunday, you will see greens that are releasing and have a bit of pop in them. And it's a remarkable course here in terms of winning scores. Koepka last year 19 under, Simpson 17 under, Fowler 17 under, Woodland 18 under, Matsuyama 17 under, 14 under, and then Koepka 15 under. So it's a lot of stability here. So, yeah, I call it resort. I'm not sure it is resort, really. I'd probably more call it a mid-score kind of, a high mid-score. So 17 to 18, 19 under par wins this. It isn't, you know, what we saw at Kapalua a few weeks ago is like 34 under and you're not winning.
No.
And that's genuine resort. So this is a plot. I've always said this golf course is a ball striker's heaven. Absolute ball striker's heaven. You've got three par fives. They're all reachable. And we're playing this at, we're also playing this at elevation, 1,250 feet above sea level. So we've got thin air, desert golf, ball travels further. And we're looking here at a 7,261-yard golf course. So in reality, you do the maths and you're reducing what? You're taking, let's say, 7, 8%. This is playing sub 7,000 yards for a par 71. The beauty of the course is that, and that's the difficulty of the course to a certain extent. If you do venture off the beaten track here, it's desert golf. There's trouble everywhere. Rocks, cactus, you've plenty of water. There's water in play on 6 of the 18 holes. So there are doubles out there, big style. But for me, Webb Simpson changed my thought on this slightly because I always thought it was a true bomber's paradise, a proper Bubba Watson track, high GIR. And it always tends to be a greens in regulation fest in the end. But Webb Simpson won this 2 years ago. So, you know, the shorter sorts, but the sorts that can hit penetrating drives and accurate drives and have still got the gumption to go for the greens. Because when you've got these par fives that are all reachable, you can't be just standing there going, oh, I'm going to wedge it in from 80 yards. To win this tournament, I think you've got to be very, very aggressive on those par fives and also, of course, the 17th. You know, you can make hay there and you can make triples as well. It seems to me it's the kind of course that Colin Morikawa would absolutely thrive on, but he never plays here, so I don't know what that's all about. But Morikawa, the sort that's so good with his long irons, penetrating long irons and also penetrating. I think the key range here is that 175 to 200 yards. Now, the greens, 7,100 square feet on average, so they're quite large. They are TIFF Eagle Bermuda grass, but they again are overseeded with Poa trivialis and a bit of ryegrass. So very, very similar to the greens that we see at PGA West, where they played the American Express a couple of weeks ago. I'm just going back through the memory bank. They're also very similar to the greens that they used to play at Redstone, which is where they used to play the Houston Open. That changed the golf club in Houston. It was renamed. They're also pretty similar to the greens that they play at the Valero Texas Open, which is where Jordan Spieth won last year and where Charlie Hoffman is always such a good player at. Mm. And if you actually look at Hoffman, I think it's Hoffman. I think Hoffman's had a second place here. He's got a decent Phoenix record. There are definite course correlations on greens. I'll go as far as saying that. In terms of those, this used to be actually overseeded with velvet bengrass, but that seems to have disappeared out of the greens. It's now ryegrass and Poa trivialis, which are the green surfaces this week that they're putting on. So yeah, great course. Risk and reward. For me, it's ball striker's heaven. If you can hit the ball long, straight, and you are a fantastic iron player, that's exactly what we're looking at this week. I'll go through the key winning factors here. Strokes gained of the champions since 2016. So Matsuyama, Woodland, Fowler, Simpson and Koepka. Where they finished in the field, average it through for these skill stats. I mean, this is very telling. Strokes gained off the tee, 11th. If you remember last week at Pebble Beach, that was immaterial off the tee. Yeah. So off the tee, 11th. Approach, 5th. Around the green, 30th. Academic. Tee to green, 5th. So that's made up largely of approach and also some strong straight driving. Strokes gained putting, 21st. So this isn't about a red hot putter. It's about steady, high GIR, avoiding trouble off the tee, but getting those, you know, penetrating drives and then going for it on the par fives and the drivable par four.
Yeah.
It's all about
yeah.
approach, bloke.
Yeah, kind of make your numbers on the fives and the short fours and hang around on the rest. And if you can put 4 days of 4 or 5 under on, then you're going to be right in the mix.
Straight 67s is never going to be a million miles away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It isn't about 62s, and it's about straight scoring, really. If you look at it from a traditional skill set, I'm covering over back to 2015 Brooks Koepka when they changed the course. Driving distance 18th, accuracy 21st, greens in regulation, you don't see this number very often. 4th across all of those winners. That's, 7 renewals. Greens in regulation, the champions averaged out at 4th.
Yeah.
Proximity to hole 11th. Yeah. So again, approach play and consistency with that approach play. Scrambling 18th, putting average 15th.
Yep.
You just see it in the names, can't you? I mean, Brooks Koepka came here. Everyone was betting him last year because he was 50-1. Had no form whatsoever. But you just look at how he plays his game. You know, fantastic driver. Can be long and straight when on form. And just high GIR. And sure enough, he won. And lots of people were on board last year, weren't they, on Koepka. Simpson's slightly different because he's a shorter in terms of his distance. But that particular year, he was driving the ball so sweetly. His GIR numbers were amazing. He was just putting brilliantly as well. He only won at 14-1, Simpson. Fowler, again, another classical golf course player, could be very buccaneering. When his driver and his approach play is great, we know what fantastic putter Fowler is. And that was an emotional victory for Ricky with the associations he's got with the organisers and with his dad, wasn't it? I can remember that. That was a very close finish as well, because Ricky almost snatched disaster from the jaws of victory like he likes to do. Gary Woodland in 2018 had been playing some really nice golf. But Woodland, again, you look at Gary Woodland, great on shorter golf courses where he can club down. High GIR man and streaky putter, and always plays well on the West Coast. That's the kind of recipe, I think. And then, of course, Hideki with his two wins in 16 and 17. It's one of those tournaments where, because it's the same course every year, the conditions seem to be similar. There's a lot of narratives, a lot of trends here you can follow. Kind of tournament I like. Anything to add, gentlemen, about the course or any views on the field that you're seeing or anything at all?
Jumping into the odds, I am absolutely baffled as to why Victor Hovland is as long as he is compared to Justin Thomas, Patrick Cantlay.
Yep.
Don't understand that.
I don't know what JT has to do to actually lengthen his odds. How badly does he have to play to... I was tempted on Thomas, and actually, I think William Hill were first up. I think they had him at 16s for about 30 seconds on first show. I'm just going into the history.
Mm.
No, I must have been imagining that. I must have dreamt to 16-1. Yeah, but yeah, 14-1 yesterday, and I've woken up this morning and he's just been backed into 12s.
The problem is he seems to not, like, with the destructive shot sets or whatever metric you want to call it, he's still putting in good performances. Like, he's got, what, a third, a fifth, and a 20th for his last four on the sheet here, Steve. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And a 20th a couple of weeks ago. So, he's there. He's threatening. And I guess that's why the odds aren't slipping. You know, he's not throwing in a missed cut or a 47th, you know, place to drift it out. I don't know. I just don't see it. Victor has won 3 times in his last 5 outings. And his missed cut here 2 years ago, he was, let's say, a younger player on tour, and he missed the cut by 1. So, I think it's...
The only question mark I had, I mean, you look at winners here. You don't seem to get many winners for a start. There seems to be a lot of the winners here haven't won for a while. I mean, you look at Koepka last year. He hadn't won, believe it or not. Koepka hadn't won on the PGA Tour or a major for 19 months. That's quite a winless streak for someone like Brooks Koepka. Webb Simpson, Hadn't won for 20 months before we won here in 2020. Ricky Fowler, our friend Ricky, Barry. 23 months since his previous win. Gary Woodland, 3.5 years since his previous win. So there's four winners there. 3.5 years, 23 months, 20 months, 19 months. Now, that doesn't shout Victor Hovland to me because he's winning pretty much every tournament he goes in at the moment. That feels, actually, if you look at that betting board, it feels more John Rahm. John Rahm hasn't won since the US Open. Justin Thomas hasn't won for 11 months since he won the Players last year. Patrick Cantlay, of course, won the Tour Championship. So that kind of, you know, if we're going down this narrative, he doesn't fit. Matsuyama doesn't fit. Hovland certainly doesn't fit. Xander does fit. I was on Xander here last year, of course, and he completely cocked up his final round and finished, you know where he finished? Second place, of course. Mm. I was on Xander. That won't surprise you. Jordan Spieth. He hasn't won now for, 9 months? I think it was the Valero Texas Open he won. Scottie Scheffler hasn't won at all. Now, I like that narrative. Daniel Berger. 12 months now he hasn't won. It was Pebble Beach last year. And yeah, he's got a bad back. Apparently, it's that and the other. But anyway, I'm on board. And then we get down to Brooks Koepka. Hasn't won since here last year, 12 months ago. So if you're going down this narrative of players that haven't won, I'm just running through it. Sam Burns, well, he's won twice since in the calendar year. Well, it's twice in the last 2 year. He doesn't fit. Finau won in New Jersey end of last year. Then we're down to the likes of Bubba Watson and Webb Simpson. Now, Webb Simpson, I don't think, has won since he won this, has he? So, again, it's 2 years since Simpson won. So, he actually fits the narrative, Simpson, there. That's kind of... I was looking at it in that kind of way. So, if you just go in those simple terms, Xander is very live here. Scottie Scheffler's very live. You do get first-time winners winning this. Berger's live. He hasn't won for a year. Kepka's live. Bubba's... I was surprised how well Bubba played. He hasn't played for years and he was right in contention last week. Webb Simpson's live. That's kind of where I'm at. And actually, if you look at the winners here and you look at their winning prices, I'm just scrolling. I spend my whole life scrolling with my mouse. It's very boring. We're looking at 50 to 1 last year for Koepka, 14 to 1 for Simpson, 22 to 1 for Ricky Fowler, 50 to 1 with Woodland. So already we've got a ceiling there of 50 to 1, last four winners. Matsuyama was 11 to 1. He was 28 to 1 the first time he won it. Koepka, 40 to 1. We have to go all the way back to Baby Walrus. Kevin Stadler, 2014. He won 125 to 1 and he beat Bubba Watson, who was 33 to 1. And here's a blast from the past. Graham Dillett. Graham Dillett was 40 to 1 when finishing, whether he was tied second or third here in 2014. 40 to 1 for Graham Dillett.
That must have been
he
one
never
of his.
Won on the PGA Tour, did he, Graham Dillett?
As I said, it must have been one of his many close calls that he got
over the years.
Did he resurface recently? I'm sure I saw his name.
Yeah, he's still trying, I believe. He's just injury riddled, isn't he?
Yeah.
Shame. Good play on his day. I mean, perfect for this golf course. Long, straight, fantastic ball strike. And when the putter worked, he was difficult to chase down. But inevitably, he always did get chased down. Bit like, who's that? Spencer Levine. He's another one. Spencer Levine always used to get on the SIGs. And you could just see him collapse on a Sunday. Right, I've gone for the following. I do like your view, Barry, on the top of the market. I mean, John Rahm, again, every golf course is perfect for John Rahm, but for me, he just doesn't win enough, 15 to 2. JT at 12s, so I haven't got a lot of interest in that. 16s, I'd have been very, very tempted. But he's still got those horrible, destructive drives in him. You actually look at his numbers around here, he always contends, he's always in the picture. But I just think his driving, probably from even 12 months ago, just is still got that. But he's still got that triple in him. Just still got it. Cantlay at 14 is a lack of course experience. Doesn't fit that narrative in terms of the... I know it sounds ridiculous, but he's actually winning too much. I've actually plumped on Matsuyama. And I'm plumping on the narrative that we discussed it before Torrey Pines. He's the sort that when he's confident can string multiple wins together. Mm. He clearly won the Zozo. He then won the Sony with a record ever strokes gained putting performance. He was 30th last time out of Torrey Pines. Finished with his best round of the week. I think he was tied 7th for scoring on Sunday. And he just comes to a course that he's absolutely fantastic at. I'm looking at our strokes gain metrics, yeah? Here's the top 10 here. Strokes gain ball striking, going back to 2016. Carl Stanley at 10, previous winner. Max Homa, 9. John Rahm, 8. Justin Thomas, 7. So JT, I said he does like the course. Connor, 6. Brandon Grace at 5. Scotty Scheffler at 4. Francesco Molinari at 3. Bearing in mind with that, he's only played here once, Molinari. Bubba Watson, won't surprise you, 2nd here for strokes gained ball striking since 2016. He's played 22 rounds of golf to accumulate that. That is amazing. And number 1, Hideki Matsuyama. And this golf course is strokes gained ball striking. That's just what it is. He tops the tree, 21 rounds. Him and Bubba. Yeah, so it kind of goes against the narrative of winners that haven't won for a while. But you go back, you actually do find some play. I mean, I remember Mark Wilson winning here in 2011. He won the Sony Open, yeah, and then came here and won this. So it does happen.
Yeah, I don't think you can scrub a player off because they're playing too
trend, well. We see these trends get broken all the time. So. Yeah. It's just the way it is. Yeah, I think Matsuyama's playing bloody good golf. He likes the greens here. They're not that grainy. He knows the course intimately. And his strokes gained approach numbers at the moment. And his drive. It's the old Hideki Matsuyama. For 2 years, we saw Hideki have terrible driving problems, inconsistent driving, very errant driving. All of a sudden, the driver's back. It's long. It's not the longest, but it's long. It's straight. And he's just standing far more in fairways. And we know what a fantastic approach player is. All you need from him is at least not a hugely negative putting performance this week. And he's right on the money.
Well, it turned into Brad Faxon when he won the other week.
That won't happen this week because I'm on board. he won't be jamming in. He won't be jamming in 7.5 strokes game putting this week. I can assure you. But this is the point. I don't think he has to. If he puts anything positive, 3/4 of a stroke positive, I think the rest of the game's in such good shape, he's going to just accumulate scores.
Mm.
So I'm on Matsuyama. I've then gone Scheffler, who I think, again, is made for this course. Long, straight, good iron player. Hasn't won on tour. That doesn't worry me so much here either with the crowd and the boisterousness because you think of Scotty Scheffler at the Ryder Cup, which was complete and utter mayhem. 3 matches, 2.5 points, and he beat John Rahm in the singles. So I think he can handle all that. He hasn't won yet, but yeah. I'm on Scheffler. I've also gone mid-range on Berger. I think Berger's made for this golf course and he's got a good record here. I think it's 3 top 10s or 4 top 11s in 7 appearances. I'm not too worried about the back. We've seen all this rubbish before about players that are injured and they pop up and win. If he pulled out of the Pebble Beach at the Pro-Am in the morning. He wasn't in the field for this. Then all of a sudden he appeared in the field. So clearly there's some kind of strategy. I think backs can be sorted. So I'm on Berger as well. I think Berger's the kind that would come along and potentially, oh God, why didn't I back Daniel Berger? The one that I know you guys are probably waiting for me to get to is Russell Henley.
Why is that?
We know that Russell Henley's on my post-it note of doom.
Yeah. So he's been scrubbed off the post-it note, is he?
Well, I just thought 50-1 for Russell Henley. I mean, we talk about prices and value, don't we? The way that Russell Henley is playing, I'm always wary of Russell Henley at 28-1, 30-1, 33-1, but 50-1. On a golf course that's all about consistent, penetrating driving, excellent approach play. I don't think that's a bad price on Henley. And actually, I look at a lot of the courses where Henley's done well at, Plantation Course, Kapalua, Wailea Country Club, TPC Boston, there seems to be a correlation to. There's a definite correlation here to people that have done well in US Opens, you know, Koepka, Simpson, Fowler, Woodland. He's a good US Open track player. Wherever I look, even Eastlake, I think he had a second or a third at Eastlake one year. Every course that correlates, I always see Russell Henley's name just popping up. And I was going through my research, and I said, Henley. And it gets to a point where you've got to say, well, stop being so ignorant and stupid and just bang him up there. 50 to 1, what is there to lose? I think Henley's playing, he's actually up to 39th or 40th in the world. It's his highest ever world ranking. And I said to you about greens, if there's one golf course that Russell Henley was an absolute specialist at, it was Redstone, the Shell Houston Open. Those greens and these greens are very, very similar in their makeup. And when I look at Russell Henley, I'm just looking at his numbers here. Traditionally, putts very well here. I'm seeing strokes gained 4.615, 3.65, 2.17. Even last year, 1.5 strokes gained putting. And he was putting abysmally at this stage last year. Just seems, the putter seems a lot better. And as we say, with all these ball strikers and guys that are so good with their approaches, all you need is some light with the putter and bang, the scoring comes. So yeah, I'm on Henley. And the final one, Keith Killer Mitchell. I've been really impressed with Keith Mitchell. He seems to be developing as a player. A lot more consistent. Isn't slashing it around off the tee. Seems to actually be taking some three woods rather than driver all the time. Working out that it isn't all about whacking it as far as you can, but actually getting the ball in the fairway helps. He's got all the tools. Fantastic driver, long driver. Good approach player. Good around the greens. I think he's a potential world top 50 elite player, Mitchell. And we all know that he's a better Bermuda grass putter than he is on any other surface. And that top 12 or 13 he got at Pebble Beach last week. I mean, Pebble is not his course. That isn't his setup at all. This is more his game. And I remember he was top 3 or 4 at the CJ Cup when they played that in Las Vegas in the fall. So yeah, Mitchell. So that's my five. Mitchell at 90s, Henley at 50s, Berger 30s, Scheffler 30s, and Hideki Matsuyama at 18 to 1. Those are my five for the Waste Management Phoenix Open. Over to you, boys.
Steve, just one thing on Henley. You're a man that loves patterns and history and stuff. Henley does not do well here on even-numbered years. Every even numbered year he misses the cut. So just in case you missed that, I don't think you can get your money back from the bookies yet or right now, or ever. I don't know. I'm not going to touch him. Off you go. If he holds firm and wins.
I did learn last week, Barry, and you learn every week, don't you? Never, ever put Kevin Kisner up on Poana. So that's a definite. Never doing that ever again. Also, I'm never backing Justin Rose unless he's a 66, 80 to 1 chance at a big tournament or a major. I might bang him in. But Rose, I wasn't impressed at all last week. Very, very poor.
No, it was a bit messy. I picked him in a one and done league, and didn't go so well. And yeah, got sucked onto the hype train.
There's something not right with Justin. Something not right. Very wrong, in fact. Anyway, that's enough of that. Who are you on?
Kisner's an interesting, not for this week in general, but Kisner's an interesting one for pro-ams because he's kind of a fastish tempo player, and maybe that pace of play in a pro-am 6 hours is just not to his liking.
It just
kind of knocks you out of your rhythm and flow, or your ideal rhythm and flow. So
Kisner, Kisner, this time of the year for Kisner is awful. His schedule is terrible because there's no courses here he likes, and he's only come here because I think he has to. As we said, you know, the next tournament you'll probably see him is Bay Hill. So he's playing all these courses he doesn't actually get on with. So anyway, he'll probably pop up and win this week, Glenn. Never been a great desert golfer either, Kevin Kisner. Whenever I've looked at Kisner for, you know, you'd thought he'd be really good at PJ West. No good there. He just doesn't seem to play well at on desert tracks. Full stop.
Mm.
Anyway.
Give me a little background. Seamus Power, desert golf. Bit of altitude. How are we getting on? Because he'll be pretty bummed about his weekend last week after, you know, roaring into the lead, a huge lead. And then going to Monterey Peninsula and the arguably the easiest of the three courses and just stalling.
Well, yeah. After that opening round at Spyglass, which was incredible, wasn't it? I think it was four shots better than anyone else in the field on that course, which, as it plays the toughest of the three generally, that was incredible, really. Yeah, shame to see him drop down after that.
I still think Seamus is learning his trade, mate. I genuinely do. You know, he's at levels that he's not used to, so, yeah.
Do you know what? But he was at a pro-am. He could have gone out and had a big old party Friday night, just enjoying the time, you know, having some seafood and some beers and some California wine. I mean, who knows? Look, things are going really well for Seamus, and, you know, kind of, if we can get, I'd be interested around 40-odd to 1. He's an unbelievable striker of the ball, and doesn't get scared about going low, and you're going to need to score pretty well this week. So it's kind of interesting to me. The extreme top of the market, nobody is appealing to me in terms of, you know, price versus player. So I think I'm just going to go with Seamus and a couple of outsiders, because we'll just break the system with the short odds.
I think Xander will be popular this week because Xander hasn't been 20-1 for time immemorial, and people will just jump on the ceiling. Xander's ceiling. They'll be saying Xander's 20-1 and Xander's ceiling's fantastic. 20-1 and Xander, actually, if you look at his results, as we've said, he's perennially short. Seamus Power, he ticks all three of my statistical boxes this week. Par breakers, ball striking, going for the green. He's had a top 10 in the desert. He's also had a top 10 at altitude. He seems to prefer medium and short golf courses than longer golf courses. So there's far worse bets than Seamus Power, yeah. Absolutely.
Do you want to go for one, Paul?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I mean, both have been mentioned a number of times and both are fairly obvious. Bubba Watson I've backed at 40-1. With eight places. You'd be proud of me. I could have taken the 45s with five places, but no, I've taken the 40-1, eight places each way. I think that differential is just about right.
Well done, Paul.
But yeah, second last week in Saudi.
Proud of you.
Thanks, Barry.
You'll finish ninth.
yeah, most likely. Yeah, as you said, Stevie, second last week in Saudi, which was about out of the blue. Just hadn't played for very much. He played in that pairs event before Christmas, didn't he? I think he was ninth or something like that. Anyway, it's only that monster putt from Harold Varner that stopped him from winning last week. He putted nicely, top 10 for greens and regulation as well. You're only getting old fashioned stats from Saudi, so you have to bear that in mind. But yeah, he was top 10 for greens and regulation, putted well on the Paspalum greens that are out there. Got a great record here in Phoenix. Five top fives from 11 starts in total. Two times, twice he's a runner-up as well. Third and fourth in his last three starts here. So
he's a shot shaper and he's a ball striker. This course is perfect for Bubba Watson, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you're getting the price because it's such a loaded field at the top end. But I thought 40-1 was well worth taking on Bubba. And I've also backed Brooks Koepka at 33s. And really, that's just to see if he goes out there and if he can bother this week, then this is the kind of course that we know he can and does win on. He won here last year after three consecutive missed cuts. He's actually in marginally better form this time. Actually, he was eighth going into the weekend at Kapalua. So that was a little bit more positive. And outside of the majors, we know that he focuses mainly on the major championships. Outside of the majors, this is the event that he actually tends to try and win, I think. So yeah, just as a little saver effectively on Brooks, just in case he does come and win. As an outsider, the one I've backed is Andrew Putnam, 125-1 I got on him, and he's got some good progressive form. 27th, 14th, 6th last week. Actually, he was leading going into Sunday last week. Sunday didn't work out for him, but yeah, decent enough for a three-figure chance. 7th here last year, got his head around the course after a couple of miscuts on his first two attempts. So that classic combination of current form and course form for a three-figure punt on Andrew Putnam. But yeah,
great in the desert, Putnam. He won the Barracuda.
Yeah,
won the Barracuda in the desert. Also, very, very, very significantly short course focused Putnam.
Yeah,
I'm just looking at my sheet here. He's just absolutely short courses, so sub sort of 7-1. That's where he makes hay. So yeah, I can make sense here with Putnam. Mm. Right, I think that's us. Should we move on to yours?
I know we're time. You've got some long ones.
One last one. You stole Putnam right out from under my nose. No, it's okay. But it's a tricky one because he's 125 five places and he's about 88 places. So,
they don't want each way money on him.
I think I might split my stake across the two just to cover it off. That's brutal.
You know that that's a bookmakers don't want to take any money on him this week for, you know, just, you know, 125 and it's 80s on the extended places.
Yeah, I know. Not interesting. I can't not back him now that I've got the blessing of Paul. And one other one is Nate Lashley, because he's popped really hard in your strokes gained model. That got me looking a little bit deeper. So he's 7th in your strokes gained model. Very good across approach, tee to green, ball striking. That's a lot of good stuff there. And he finished 28th last week. All, you know, fine for me. And he's a 3rd and a 17th here his last 2 years. So I just have to pick the correct combo of places and odds. I think I'll probably take him 150s, 8 places versus 175s, 5 places.
Yep.
And that's me.
Let's move on to the DP World Tour. And also, I heard Barry say European Tour earlier, so that goes into the charity box.
okay, done.
DP World Tour,
Paul. Let's move on.
Yeah, it's tough. I'll tell you what's difficult is trying to write a preview where you're not referring to the European Tour, because all of the past events are European Tour victories or European Tour events. And, you know, trying to convert that into DP World Tour language when it was a European Tour event back in the day is...
Maybe you need clarification from Wentworth HQ whether you can still use European Tour in post results. You'll probably get a response within 3 years. So send them an email now.
Yeah, well, it's still relatively new still, so I'm a little bit sensitive to it when I'm writing.
They'll ask Keith if you can do that. Can we still use European Tour in terms of past results, Keith? Yeah. Oh, we'll have a committee meeting and discuss it.
I expect in a month's time I really won't care and I'll just be writing whatever I like. Anyway,
I think you're all right, Paul. I mean, and the other thing that's tricky is that their website is still europeantour.com. you're typing into the address bar. So unless they just, it's just there, it's screaming in your face, you know, so just,
they're not helping themselves.
No.
It's true as well.
They have put DP World in as part of the URL string now, but yes, it's it's still kind of part of the mix, isn't it? Anyway, let's talk about Raz Al-Khaimah Mark II. He's staying in the area for a second consecutive week. And actually, the bookies are expecting a repeat performance by all accounts. Last week's top two are the first two in the betting as it stands right now. Nikolai Højgaard, 14-1. He finished first. He won by 4 shots last week. From Jordan Smith, who's 16-1 this week, and he finished second. He was three shots clear of the rest of the field. So the bookies are very much expecting a similar kind of output this week by the looks of it. Thomas Detry's third favourite, 25-1, alongside Bob McIntyre, Adrian Ause, all the same price. Adrian Meronk's 28-1. Rasmus Højgaard 30-1, Romain Langasque at 33s, and 35-1 bar those top eight players that I've just mentioned. It's largely the same field as last week, actually. A few notable additions, they include Adrian Nelson, just mentioned. He won here in 2018 on the Challenge Tour. Justin Harding's playing this week. Rafa Cabrera-Bello's playing. Laurie Cantor's been added to the field, but it's kind of 80-85% the same as last week. And of course, we're playing on the same course as last week as well. So you can see why the bookies have kind of gone down this repeat performance approach with their pricing. And we got a good look at the course last week. 24 under was the winning total, so very much a resort course as we'd expected. Just to recap the course itself, is a Peter Harradine design, 7,325 yard par 72, typical coastal desert affair, wasn't it? Paspalum greens, attackable par fives, a few short par fours in there as well. And like last week, the only notable breeze that we're going to get is likely to be on Sunday afternoon. In fact, if anything, the breeze in the week looks to be slightly less than it was last week. So I don't know. Can they go deeper than 24 under? Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's going to be in that kind of region again, I think, this week, unless they decide to particularly tuck the pins away and try and differentiate it from last week. But I'm not sure there's a great deal they can reasonably do with that course to make it considerably different from one week to the next. We shall see. And of course, versus last week, we've got the benefit of last week's events results and some strokes gained numbers to give us a little bit of a clue as to who might be suited best now a further week on. And if you look at the top two last week and the strokes gained numbers from the first two past the post, Nicolai Højgaard was first for strokes gained off the tee. He was also first for strokes gained tee to green. He absolutely smashed it from off the tee and from tee to green. Jordan Smith was second for strokes gained off the tee, seventh for strokes gained tee to green. So those guys pretty much achieved their positions in very, very similar fashion. And in fact, if you look at the top six finishers, it was only Adrian Ategui who really deviated from that that kind of ball-striking tee to green template. He topped strokes gained putting, whereas the rest of the guys in the top five, or top six rather, were again very strong from off the tee, very strong from tee to green. So yeah, the summary from that, strong driving, strong tee to green game seemed to be the way ahead. If you break down the scoring as well that we saw last week, Jordan Smith and Højgaard again, both of them were 10 under for the par fours on the week. The only difference between the two really was that Nicolai was 15 under on the par five, Smith was 9 under. So really the differential between the two was how well that Nicolai Højgaard played the par fives over the course of the week. I wouldn't say that par five scoring is absolutely critical. It may well be the kind of final differential between the winner and the second or third place finishers. But if you look at some of the players who finished just behind Smith and Højgaard, they were kind of 6 under, 8 under for the par fives, which is kind of what you'd expect for holes that are that length on a course like that is attackable. So it was only when you got really ahead of the game with the par five scoring like Nicolai Højgaard did that it makes a huge difference. What else have we got? Looking at the current form, last week I'd listed the current form of the three Challenge Tour winners coming into this, Adrian Aus, Jens Dantorp and Jordan Smith. And all three of those had a top four finish in their previous three starts. And Højgaard, despite having 2022 form of miscut, had finished fourth on his event prior to Christmas, second and fourth were his last two event finishes coming into the back end of 2021. So he fits that narrative as well. So if you want to get as absolutely taking a knife to the field as deep as that, then you could look at players who've only finished in the top four from their last three starts and see where that leaves you. Of course, trends like that are there to be absolutely blown out of the water. So, take it with a pinch of salt. But Højgaard was there to be picked. You look back a week on, and I really did toy with putting up Rasmus and Nicolai last week. And ultimately, I just went with Rasmus, which,
Many have said that Nicolai is going to be the better player, haven't they?
Yeah, it's difficult to tell. I mean, in terms of wins, Rasmus had kind of stolen the march on his brother. But if you switch it around now, Nikolai's got a higher world ranking. He's got the momentum. He's got two wins from his last, 12 starts or where it is now. The pair of them are going to be massive players of the future. They're going to be Ryder Cup players. They're going to be PGA Tour players eventually. It's going to be fascinating to see how they progress, the pair of them, over the next few years. Boil it all down, I think it's going to be another birdie fest. I think we've got to focus on strong off the tee game. I think we've got to focus on strong tee to green games. And ultimately, you've just got to be able to convert a few putts on these Paspalum greens that we saw last week. I've gone for four. Just narrowed it down to four this week. I'm taking on the market leaders with Adrie Arnaus at 25-1. I mentioned earlier that he won the Challenge Tour event here. It was the grand final back in 2018. And he's been knocking on the door ever since on the, as it was, European Tour, now DP World Tour. Top 10s at Portugal and Dubai to close out the year last year. They were quite impressive. He was 20th in Abu Dhabi. He had that flying final round that I talked about a couple of weeks back when I backed him in Dubai and he missed the cut. He was third last week in Saudi. And it was only that finish from Bubba and Varner the third. Both of them made birdie equal over the final two holes that finally shook him off. And he had a great chance to win last week. And it was just very flat or went backwards, kind of the mid part of the round on Sunday. But other than that, it was pretty good. Second for putting average on the Paspalum greens last week at Royal Greens Golf and Country Club over in Saudi. So that's a good tick for this week. What caught my eye, though, from his Saudi performance was he was 16th for greens in regulation. That was his best greens in regulation stat since April last year. Bear in mind, there's no strokes gained numbers out of last week, as I mentioned earlier. So we're looking at that raw number. But 16th for greens in reg. He was also strong from off the tee. He had his best driving accuracy stat since the start of 2020 that I've seen registered last week as well. So strong from off the tee, strong with his irons. Very strong on the Paspalum greens last week. That sounds like a match made in heaven for a course that he's already proven to be victorious on. So puts all that together this week, I think he's going to go very, very close to nabbing that first win, Adrie Arnaus, at 25-1. So Arnaus is in. I've stuck with Rasmus. I've stuck with Rasmus Højgaard for a second week. Same price, 30-1. We've already seen these back-to-back Højgaard victories back in the autumn of last year. Rasmus won at Crans Soucier. Nikolai won the week after, inspired by his brother's win at the Italian Open. Perhaps it'll be reversed this week. Perhaps we'll see Nikolai take a step back and Rasmus come through and add another Højgaard victory to the list of players getting over the line on the DP World Tour. I mean, the rivalry between the pair is going to ramp up, as we just mentioned, over the years. 67th in the world now is Nikolai, 108th for Rasmus. He'll be looking to equalise that as soon as he reasonably can, I'm sure. I watched a lot of Rasmus last week, as you'd expect. I was on him. I think my summary was that he played really quite well for 3 days. And it was one hole. It was the short par four fifth that really was the killer for him.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. Birdie and double. I saw that in his first two rounds.
Yeah. Well, he doubled it on the first day. Then he went bogey, bogey, bogey for the other 3 days. This is a short kind of 340-yard, right condition, drivable par four. And he absolutely butchered it. Now, if you turn that around, and on another day, another week, he makes birdie, 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 par or something like that. You know, or makes an eagle and a couple of birdies. He plays it entirely different. And, you know, had he done that over the first 3 days, he'd have been going out in the final group on Sunday with a real chance of winning rather than where he was kind of mid-pack and throttling down for the final round as his brother went and won the title. I'm not concerned where he finished last week. I think the course suits him. I think that he can get his head around that short par four and the rest of his game should be there or thereabouts. He had so many chances last week, so many chances on the greens. If he can just get his head around that, those Paspalum putting surfaces ahead of this Thursday, then I think he's going to go really, 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 really close, Rasmus. So, sticking with him, keeping the faith. Another one I've backed is Danny Van Tonda at 50-1. He caught the eye last week after a slow start. He was 3 over through his first 3 holes on Thursday. Eventually shot a 73. Everyone else was making birdies for fun, and he was trying to claw it back to level par. Nearly got there. After that, shot 68, 69, 65, closed the bogey-free Sunday. Some really good momentum going into this week. Won the South African Open in December. That was the one that got taken off the DP World Tour schedule. So that was just a Sunshine Tour win, his 8th Sunshine Tour win now. But he's also won on what was the European Tour. He won the Kenya Savannah Classic last year. Kenya Savannah Classic, rather, last year. And that was another one of these double headers. That was the second week of the Kenya double. And he missed the cut the first week, got his head around it, and won the second week. And I suspect from the momentum that we saw last week, he can go really quite close this week. 7th strokes gained off the tee for the full season last year. That's bang on for what I'm looking in terms of the key metrics for this week. And when he's on his game, off the tee to green is absolutely where he is. So hopefully he puts that all together again this week and gives it a really good go. And finally, I've taken a chance on Andy Sullivan. 70-1 I took on Sullivan. And when you look at a resort 24 under style course, it absolutely screams a player like Sullivan. And you're getting this price because he started the season off poorly. He started 2022 off poorly, a missed cut and a 47th or something along those lines for the first two starts this season. Didn't play last week. But if you go back to the back end of last year, he was 4th at the Fire Course in Dubai back in November. That was strong. He's got some really good form in the region, actually. He was 2nd at the DP World Tour Championship back in 2015. Got another couple of top 10s there. 4th, as I said, at the Fire Course. Also 2nd the year before. 2nd, 4th and 6th at the Dubai Desert Classic over the years as well. So in terms of kind of regional form, just down the road in Dubai, is absolutely spot on. In terms of getting this kind of target score, he won the Portugal Masters at 23 under par. He won the English Championship at 27 under par. Both of them, he absolutely lapped the field in both instances. So when he can find his game and when he gets himself on these low-scoring resort courses, he can absolutely mop up. So I thought 70-1 was well worth taking on a player of Andy Sullivan's pedigree with 4 historical European Tour wins over the years. So that's my 4. Andy Sullivan, Danny Van Tonda, Rasmus Højgaard and Adrie Arnaus. And hopefully one of those guys can get over the line with any luck. Barry, any from you?
Struggling. Top of the market, I'd probably go with you on Adrie Arnaus. Jump in on that. Lines up quite well. Beyond that, I don't know. Steve, any
I haven't really looked inspiration? At it, to be honest. I've been flat on the Phoenix Open, but Arnaus, I mean, we've been talking about him forever. He's got to get over the line at some point.
Yeah.
Russ, and I must say, Andy Sullivan, he does fit the bill. How long's this golf course?
7-3, and, you know, in desert conditions, warm, the ball flies a bit, doesn't it? It doesn't play long.
You think he's all right around that distance?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, he does like a mid-20s under par.
Yeah.
Andy
Sullivan. Oh yeah, absolutely.
And he always contends from no form whatsoever.
Yep.
Yeah. You're actually backing the ceiling there with Sullivan, which isn't a bad shout, is it?
70-1. There's not much in terms of superior overall quality ahead of him in the field here. It's just predicated on what he's done over his last couple of starts at the start of this year.
I get that.
And the last off my list was Callum Shinquin. So if you want to,
all right, lump on.
If you want to go for one, that's...
lump on, listeners. Yeah. Callum Shinquin.
Shinquin was the one player. If I'd have put 5 up this week, it would have been Shinquin as well, but I can't justify adding another one into the mix. But if you fancy another one and you fancy gloating when he wins next week, then stick Shinquin in. But that's me.
I think that's us, chaps, isn't it? We're done.
Indeed.
We don't know what the tournaments are next week because the Indian Open seems to have been cancelled, but there's been no official word from the DP World Tour. But I will be around, and it is it the Genesis Invitational next week, I believe?
Yes.
I better check it. Let me just check. Check. It is the Genesis Invitational. That will be absolutely loaded from Riviera Country Club. Mm-hmm. The last leg of the West Coast swing. We then move into Florida. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Should be good.
Great start.
Thank you for your time, gentlemen, and good luck with your bets.
Yeah, best of luck, boys.
Good luck, guys.
Best of luck to the listeners, and we'll be back next week for the Genesis Invitational. Goodbye.
If you like betting on golf, but everyone that you back misses the cut, get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the Golf Betting System. The Golf Betting System is the Golf Betting System.